Dobbs, Huckabee, Hannity, Levin, and Lars. The truth is here. Freedom 970. The five pillars of freedom on Freedom 970, KUFO AM, Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Question. We have in studio today, Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Turn your mics on.
What?
Turn the mics on. There you go.
Ah, little snafu there. Hopefully, that does help to turn the microphones on. Welcome to Investing Simplified, another wonderful Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon. And if you have a question, give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We do have a couple of lines open, so give us a call. I'd like to introduce in studio today my co-host, Kevin Stege with the CPA firm at Baker Colson.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Kevin.
Hello.
And Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Did you guys have a great week?
Always do.
You know, I had a really great week this week. It was a short week, which makes it great. And then...
And that was because it was short because...
Because of Memorial Day.
Uh-huh. And like playing golf yesterday?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I it was my birthday, so I had an excuse. A friend of mine took me to play golf, and we walked 18 holes out at Pumpkin Ridge, Witch's Hollow course, and it was a pretty cool, pretty good time out there. And, of course, that's kind of a famous course out there, too, because Tiger Woods, I believe it was either – the U.S. Amateur or the, I think it was the U.S. Amateur.
Yeah.
He won out there.
Yeah.
And they've got a great picture of him out there in the hall and stuff. So it's a great place, but I'm telling you, walking 18 really tells you how bad a shape you're in because you feel it real quick. Well, you know, we've had some exciting things going on in the economy, and I'm just going to give a little verbiage here about one thing that I heard. We all know that college costs are going up and up and up. In fact, college tuition is going up higher than any other thing in our economy, the costs are. And I just have to say that I was a little one of the facts that a lot of people don't realize, and there's a book out recently about is a college education necessary or not necessary, and then, you know, depending on the profession you're in. But only 35% of the people in the United States have an actual accredited college degree. There are many, many people who claim to have one that don't have one, but there it's 35% of the population. So it's 65% don't. And I was a little concerned when the president this week made a statement about that we've got to do something about the the debt that our college students are going into, but he totally ignores the over $1 trillion a year just in fake money he's printing every month, $85 billion, that every one of us have to pay, including those kids who go to college. I mean, right now that debt, if everybody in the United States, I think it's something like about $150,000 per person, well, that's a lot of money. Well, that's a heck of a lot of money.
It sure is. And then on top of that, with Obamacare, the way that when you start spreading the risk out of insuring everybody, that's going to hit the young people. So they're going to be stacked on pretty hard.
Yeah, I was watching a news show in the morning, and one of them was talking about the in California what the rates were going to be. And I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like 300% higher for somebody under 25 to buy insurance in the state of California. And I tell you, for young people, it's tough enough if they're trying to go out there, get their first job, get through school. Now, if you're at home and you're able to be covered on your parents, that's, I think you can go to 25 now. But gosh, if you're out there trying to get a job, you're trying to pay for your college loan, you're trying to get a job, and then you got to pay these higher rates for insurance, it's making it pretty tough on young people.
You know what's amazing is the complexity of the Affordable Health Care Act. I had a business client here not too long ago ask a question about it, and it had to do with the fact that with multiple organizations, multiple companies, sort of under an umbrella company, and there's a whole huge section. I mean, it's like 90 pages long on determining whether or not the idea behind this structure, or the hope behind this structure, was that not all of the employees would have to be covered. Wrong. What they basically, in a nutshell, what they did was they netted all of the employees of all of the companies under this umbrella into the same deal, and said, you know, since basically all of these are controlled by the same outfit, you know, they're all your employees, and you got to cover them all. And if you don't, it's a $2,000 penalty.
In other words, you can't split your company into two smaller companies that don't qualify to.
Well, yeah. It's not that simple, but that was the general idea. But what it was amazing was the complexity of the definitions of everything in this thing. I mean, the definitions of employees, the definitions of entities, it was just amazingly complex.
Well, we at Baker & Colson, we're literally going to be spending thousands of dollars this year alone getting our staff trained, getting ourselves educated, learning about every single nuance of this, because not only do we have to advise individuals as they look at whether they want to take the penalty, whether they want to take insurance, what are their options, but we also have to advise small businesses on what plans to set up we'll be basically doing health insurance planning like we do estate planning.
Well, and the thing about it is I was looking at this you know, set of regulations was like 90 pages, and that was just one chunk of it. It wasn't like everything.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an amazingly difficult task, and it's going to be a challenge for a lot of people.
It's kind of interesting, Kevin. I wish I could have had you in an interview I had the other day, because I had a guy in, and he was trying to figure out how he could bury money. He wanted to set up an account either in the Cayman Islands or someplace to bury money, and I tried to explain to him that, you know, a lot of this stuff is over-exaggerated and overblown what people are doing. Most people that have those accounts are still reporting to the IRS, still paying to the IRS. They're not doing tax avoidance. They're trying to do tax planning, and there is a big, big difference. Mm-hmm. And when you try to avoid paying any tax at all, you're going to jeopardize yourself for some tax penalties and possibly jail. So you got to be careful with what you're trying to do. And I was trying to explain to him that we all operate under the same rules and regulations. There are only so many things you can do. When you hear about this stuff, you sometimes have to take it with a grain of salt, because when people say, oh, he buried this money over in the Cayman Islands, he never paid any tax on it, never paid. Well, how's he going to bring it back? You know, so I'm sure you guys encounter that from time to time. People come to your office and say, hey, I want to bury this money. And this guy was trying to figure out, he had a couple different companies, and he wanted to set up, like this, he wanted to set up a defined benefit in one company, and then he's setting up a 401k for his employees. And I said, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You can't contribute more, because then you've overstepped the boundaries of your 401k. Mm-hmm. He said, well, I just won't contribute to that. I'll just put the money in for the employees. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a – you have to be I mean, if you want to be cutting edge and flirt around with the gray areas and all, you know, I hope you have some good sleeping pills, because you're not going to be sleeping well at night. And you know, and it's an interesting balancing act, you know, between everyone paying what they should pay in their taxes and not cheating on your taxes, but paying the lowest amount that you're supposed to pay. And if everybody did that, theoretically, we would not have this deficit that we have because of the huge amount of underpayments and cheating that goes on to some degree. But then on the flip side, if the government got everything they were due, they'd take your firstborn too. So,
well, you know, I'll tell you, I don't have any sympathy for somebody who doesn't pay their taxes at all,
right?
And just tries to get out of having to pay them because we do have to. I'm pretty conservative, no question about it. But we do have to have a government. We do have to have money to pay for those things.
Yep.
There are things the government does for you that you can't do for yourself, but that does not mean creating a job or paying you money for not working. I don't think that's the government's job at all. I think the government should be there to promote prosperity for every American citizen and encourage you to get back to work as soon as possible with incentives, not decentives. So, but paying taxes is something that we all have to do. I've been doing it since I've been working, as you guys have too, and we all have to pay. It's just the way it is. But, you know, speaking about paying, the markets have been really, really volatile. I don't know if you guys have been watching. I know you probably are not like me where I have my business station on every day and I'm watching it on the TV. But, you know, the Dow Jones had kind of a tough week at the end of the week. Went down 200 points yesterday.
You know, I heard that was attributable to just several sources, though. It was like one of the Johnson & Johnson medical part, and then one was something else, like oil or something.
Well, you know, depending on which broadcaster you hear, some people claim that the lower end of the week was because Bernanke intimated that he was going to quit printing money. So, you know, you always hear all these kinds of things. There's always an excuse why the market crashed, or why the market went up, or why the market did this or did that. But the reality is, if more and more people are putting money into the markets are going to go up. If people are pulling money out of the markets are going to go down. It's pretty simple, basic math. And there might be reasons why people have confidence to put money in the market or they have confidence not to put it in the market. But at the end of the week, the Dow Jones closed at 15,115.57. It was down 208 points for the day, and that was 1.36%. And there again, anytime I see volatility in the market of over 1% in a day, that concerns me personally because we have such a big market to begin with. But since the market correction in 10907, which is actually almost 6 years, it's 5.5 years ago, the Dow Jones has recovered and is up 6.71% in 5.5 years. That means it's made an average of 1.22% for the 5.5 years, which again, that's not an exciting number for to take a risk. The S&P closed at 1630.74, and very similar to the Dow Jones, the S&P 500 is up 4.19% since 10907. And in 5.5 years, that's an average annual return of 0.76, almost what you could get in a bank money market account. Of course, those are about 25 basis points. That's not real exciting numbers for taking a risk. Oil closed at 91.61. Last week was 93. That is good news. The only thing is, like we've said on the radio station several times, just because oil goes down doesn't mean it goes down at the pump. I wish it did. And gold closed at $13.95, and last week was $13.85. And, you know, I talk about Harry Dent in a lot of the comments that Harry Dent makes, and he's on CNBC almost regularly, and he's on the Fox Business News Network too as well. And, you know, he strictly looks at demographics about the population, and it makes sense. The more we spend, the more we go out there and put money in the economy, the more the economy is going to grow. But all of us baby boomers, we're not buying like we used to. We're not buying the new things. We're not buying things. And, in fact, the general public now are not buying new cars. They're waiting to keep their car a little longer than just turning it over every 3 or 5 years. They're now waiting, you know, 8 to 10 years And that's got to affect the economy. So we all want the economy to do good. I mean, there's nobody, I hope there's nobody sitting around saying, boy, I hope the economy fails today because I want Joe Schmuck elected or whatever. I don't think any of us want the economy to do bad. We all want it to do good because we all live in it day to day. So we want to see it turned around. But you also got to be realistic and you got to look at what's going on. And I believe personally that there's going to be a very tough 5 to 7 year period in the markets. But I believe there's also going to be a lot of great opportunity in the markets. And I think there's some great opportunities coming here in the short range and in the mid range. And so there's going to be some opportunities to make money in the market. You just got to be careful what you're doing. And I wouldn't bet the farm on any one particular thing because I think you might end up getting caught short. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come right back with Investing Simplified. And we're going to talk to Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm about some estate planning ideas with Carl's comments. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified. By the way, we do have a couple lines open there if you want to give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
We do Investing Simplified.
Let's face it, the rules of retirement have changed. What we were told to do just a few years ago now seems like a pipe dream. Hi, this is Michael Burnett for Chuck Price, owner of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. You know the drill. Be a loyal employee. You'll get a pension. Your home will be worth 10 to 20 times what you paid for it when you retire. So how's that working for you? Call Chuck Price right now. He's located right here in Portland. Featured expert on Investing Simplified on AM 970. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or close to retiring, and he focuses on protection of principal and tax strategies to minimize your taxes. Call right now and get Chuck's retirement report. It's packed full of information on generating more income during retirement, how to leave more to your heirs, and so much more. 503-253-3000. Chuck Price, Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and this is the time for Carl's comments. And today I'd like to revisit a couple of things, but one is I'd like to revisit a subject that I talked about earlier about one of the techniques for estate planning that the Oregon legislature gave us in 2011, and it's called a transfer on death deed. And the way that that works is that is the same way as like an insurance policy. You designate a beneficiary on a deed, and that allows your real property to transfer to your beneficiary upon your death by operation of law without going through probate. Sounds like a wonderful idea. However, there's a little problem, and I identified this way back then when it first came out, and that is that the same law that allows you to do that also creates an 18-month waiting period within which creditors can make a claim. Now, 18 months is a pretty long time, and so I wondered what was going to happen there, because it would work out fine if your beneficiaries are going to keep the house or the property. That works out just fine. But what if they want to turn around and sell it or need to turn around and sell it because there's an estate tax issue? Well, the problem is that, and I've just learned this here just recently, is that the title insurance companies are saying, no, we are not going to insure this house unless it goes through probate. Because a probate, that's one of the good things about probate, is it will cut off the claims of creditors. And it can cut off the claims of creditors in a period of four months. So, and the idea is that the title company will not insure these things because they're afraid of unknown creditors. So, for example, if the decedent had been, say the decedent had been a dentist or something and had committed an act of malpractice when they were uninsured, and nobody knew about it, and 1 year, 364 days after the guy dies, the claim gets risen. So they don't want to have that kind of claim. They're pretty rare. It's very unusual. But nonetheless, the title insurance companies are not in the business of insuring the title unless they're absolutely satisfied that it's going to be fine. So that may put my guess is that kind of almost defeats the purpose in a sense. So my suggestion probably would be, unless your children or whoever your beneficiaries are going to be are going to keep that house and they want to keep it for maybe they've got a child who's living there or wants to live there or something like that. My suggestion might be to go with the trust idea and do it that way, or just go with a straight out will and go through the probate process. Because with the trust situation, what happens is the creditor risk goes on the beneficiaries. In other words, if the house goes to the goes to the children, and I always ask them this when they are administering a trust, I say, so if you're going to sell all this stuff, you're responsible for paying creditors. So you need to make sure you do a due diligence search to make sure that there aren't any known creditors. And they say, we know there aren't any creditors because mom lived in this house forever and she didn't do anything. She didn't have any outstanding medical care. She didn't go on Medicaid. You know, we've been through all of her mail for the last, 6 months, and we found nothing that says there's any creditors. And then they say, well, it's your risk, but, then you can distribute all of the assets, and you can sell a house, and you can do whatever you want. The title company's not going to want to take that risk. so that's the reason for that. So, but because the trust distributes the assets or sells the asset, the risk goes on the beneficiaries and the trustee, not on the title company. So kind of that might be one of the ways that we would handle that situation. I'm not saying that the transfer on death deed doesn't have its place, but I think it's not as useful as it might have been. The other thing you could do, I suppose, is just go through the probate process, but that sort of defeats the purpose. The probate process can be fairly expensive, but it is relatively quick compared to 18 months. I mean, you could at least sell the house within the 4-month period and hold the money for 4 months and then distribute it after that 4-month period. So you can do a transfer on death deed plus a probate, or you could not do a transfer on death deed and just do the probate. Or I think that you could do it in a living trust and have your own, kind of personal assurances that there are no outstanding debts and just realize that there might be some slight risk. So that was my comment on an old technique that just came out by the Oregon legislature.
Interesting. So if you were to just do the transfer on death, you could wait the 18 months and then sell it after that, and that would be okay.
Absolutely. Then okay. They'd insure it. And the problem is that's a long time. And you also have some other issues because, say, for example, you've got who's entitled? Well, you're entitled to that thing. That means that you're going to have to insure it during those 18 months. The beneficiary's entitled. And so they're going to have to insure it. And if they want to rent it out, I guess they can do that. But if they really need the money, if they want to cash out the money, say, for example, there are three beneficiaries. And they want their money. And that's going to be awkward. So I think it could be a challenge, but there are ways. Like I said, if it means that much to them, they can go ahead and do the probate. And if it's one asset, you could do it fairly inexpensively, although it's still going to cost them some money. It's going to take a little bit of time. So just a thought. Some other thoughts that came to my mind as we were talking about end-of-life planning kinds of things, estate planning, I came across a booklet that the Department of Human Resources has, and it's called Being Prepared, a Resource Guide for End-of-Life Decisions in Planning. And it's kind of like a little workbook, and it gives suggestions on how to talk to your family. It gives suggestions on important information that provides guidance about your finances. It has health-related information, including health directives, and information on funerals and burials and cremations and resources that can help. I'm not going to go through it, but many of the things that are in it are the things that I've talked about how to plan for doing things and how to do advanced directives and durable powers of attorneys and trusts and all of that kind of stuff. But it's a nice little way to kind of work through it in a kind of a workbook fashion. And you can get it from the Department of Human Services. Again, it's calling Being Prepared, a resource guide for end-of-life decisions and planning. So just another little tip. And it also has some definitions of various things, and it's also got some helpful, you know, resources, numbers, people that you can call. And so it's kind of a useful tool, and I would suggest that you get one from the Department of Human Services or not, but but I think if you're a little bit new to the idea and you're a little bit concerned about how to go about doing it, you know you need to do it, but you've been putting that off, and you want to take the step, but you don't want to go all the way to the lawyer's office yet, well, this is a good start because it helps you organize your thoughts. So just a little suggestion or a comment for Carl's comments today.
Okay, that's great. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We do have a couple lines open here if you want to give us a call. 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And we'll be right back with the tax investigator.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
All right. Well, you are listening to Investing Simplified here in Portland, Oregon, broadcasting live here on a great Saturday morning. Give us a call with your tax, legal, or financial questions at 503-417-7626. Today on the Tax Investigator, we're going to take a look at, and I think this will spur some interesting discussion, we're going to take a look at the 15 biggest tax breaks that the that our Internal Revenue Code gives us. And this is going to be in terms of dollar amounts to the federal government or in your pocket. And I think what will be interesting about this is it will kind of spur conversation on where Congress may look in the future to harvest more cash for the governments. And you may fit into one of these 15 pools, or you may not. You may fit into, I doubt you'll fit into all of them. If you do, you got a lot going on, but I think you'll find yourself somewhere in here. And so we're going to start with, and we're going to have a little quiz. We're going to start with number 15 and work our way down to number 5. And once we get to 5, I'll start taking guesses from you gentlemen or our listeners on what you think numbers 1 through 5 are. So number 15, this is, again, the most expensive tax breaks to the government or the most beneficial tax breaks to individuals. So this is individual taxation, not corporate taxation, or business taxation. So the first number 15 is untaxed Social Security. Obviously, the federal government only taxes a maximum of 85% of your Social Security. Many recipients aren't taxed on it at all because if you don't have a certain amount of other income, you're not going to be subject to Social Security tax. So this saves individuals a tune of $180 billion over a five-year period. These are over a five-year period, so these numbers that I give you. So this is our number 15 on the list is untaxed Social Security, $180 billion. Number 14, cafeteria plans from your employer, which is going to be group term life, your flexible spending arrangement, your child care benefits that you get from your employer that the federal government doesn't tax. This is a benefit you get. They don't tax it. $193 billion. We're not up to the $200 billion yet. Number 13. Oops, now we're up to $200 billion. $212 billion. And this is kind of interesting, kind of low on the list, Chuck. Defined benefit retirement plans. Now, this isn't defined contribution. This is defined benefit, kind of old school.
Yeah, it's really it's really limited now because of the requirements to sole proprietors. So unless you're a sole proprietor, you're probably never going to do a defined benefit plan.
That's right. And typically, it's usually a pretty pretty profitable businesses that do that, that have a chunk of cash to put away. So this is one that maybe favors more of the wealthy in our in the society. And you'll see across this list, you'll see a pretty good cross section of welfare type benefits and tax breaks for, you know, investing and the wealthy. So that's number 13 at $212 billion over 5 years. Number 12, this one always, I know, gets your juices flowing, Chuck. Muni bond interest, non-taxable to the federal and state governments.
Keep your hands off.
That's right, keep your hands off. And, you know, they've kind of mulled around changing that, but, boy, that would be, I don't think that one's going to change.
I think the blow to municipalities would be devastating.
Exactly. $217 billion. Number 11. Now we're getting into itemized deductions. And this is charitable contributions. So this is going to be your tax write-offs due to charitable contributions. Now, this doesn't mean all giving that's given to charity, because a lot of people give to charity and they don't have a taxable income and there's no tax benefit, or they don't itemize. And so there's no tax savings there. $224 billion for charitable write-offs over a five-year period. Number 10, we are current and cutting. Obamacare insurance exchange subsidies comes in at number 10 on the list. So families who are within 400% of the federal poverty level are going to be entitled to some sort of subsidy of their required health insurance coverage. And you'll eventually find out where we fit once we know all the rules on that. But that can be a family up to about $90,000 of income, because federal poverty is around $20,000-$25,000. So 400% of that would put a family of four up near, you know, $90,000-$95,000. So that is going to cost the federal government $238 billion. Now, of course,
now this is accumulative, right? Are each of these different? Like, is that just that alone?
Just that alone.
Wow.
Yeah, that's over a five-year period.
Okay,
so,
yeah, but that's still a lot of money.
It still is a lot of money. That's number 10, in the insurance exchange subsidies. Number 9, Carl, this gets into our area, is stepped-up basis at date of death. That saves the taxpayers about $258 billion, that little caveat that allows you to take appreciation off the table, and the beneficiaries don't have to pay tax on the appreciation. And we'll come back and talk about this here in a second. There's some interesting things going on there. So that is number 9, $258 billion, stepped up basis at date of death. Number 8, the $1,000 child tax credit. With all the children that we have under the age of 17, that alone cost the federal government $292 billion, almost up to $300, and it saves families $292 billion in taxes with the $1,000 child tax credit. Number 7, earned income credit. Now, here's our first welfare-based tax credit, tax savings, and this comes in at $326 billion. of which about $283 billion of that was is going to be refundable to people. So in other words, you didn't have to have a tax liability to even generate that. So earned income credit is a not typically going to be one that's going to be touched in the future by Congress and such, because that's the lower income earning people, or I guess you do have to have income, but sometimes non-earning folks. So number six, now we're starting to get into the heavy hitters at $336 billion 401k deferral for employees. When you defer into your 401k the $16,500 or the $22,500 maximum that you're allowed to defer of your income and pay at a later date, that comes in at $336 billion. Now, that doesn't include excluding the earnings that those 401k accounts make over that time. So that's just the deferral. Now we are into numbers 5 through 1, and we will start taking guesses as to what items might fit in here. And I think a couple of them you guys probably...
Well, the number one I'm thinking of, and I haven't heard it yet, is the interest deduction on your mortgage.
Amen. I was going to pick the same one.
That's
the one that glares out to me. That may be number one.
That is not number one. But you guys are spot on. That is in the top five. That's number four, actually. So that is a very good guess. So number five, and this one surprised me. I hadn't even thought of this as a tax savings, but if the tax structure is such that when you are when you gain in financial stature, the Internal Revenue Code says you're taxed on that gain at some point, or unless you fit a particular exclusion. Well, tax-free Medicare benefits. Now, we've paid into Medicare throughout our lives via W-2 withholdings, the Medicare portion of the Social Security Medicare tax that we pay as employees. And then you also pay, as a Social Security recipient, you also pay about $100 a month into Medicare. But the benefit that you get that exceeds the amount that you've paid in is non-taxable. And that's, to a huge extent, a very big savings for people.
I'm going to throw a caveat here.
Do that, Chuck.
Yeah. Here's the problem with this whole thing. What the government's saying is here's your money. We're owed these things, even though you've earned it. You're depriving us of getting our cut out of what you've done. And that's the fallacy of the whole thing, because, you know, it's your money.
I don't disagree with you. I would never have even considered this as a...
They acted as if it's their money.
Yes, exactly. $358 billion.
Whoa.
Yeah, so... Now we're getting into the heavy hitters again. Mortgage interest deduction comes in at number four, $379 billion. This is for folks that use a Schedule A and itemized deductions and take the home mortgage interest deductions. I'm sure that includes mortgage insurance premiums. It doesn't include the exclusion of gain when you sell your home and you've lived in it for 2 out of 5 years, and you can exclude up to $500,000 of gain. It doesn't include that.
Those ships have sailed here of late, though.
That's true. There's not a ton of gain. In fact, that particular exclusion doesn't even make the top 15.
Yeah.
So, number three is state and income tax and real estate taxes that you deduct on your Schedule A. $431 billion. So folks are paying a lot into the state income tax, you know, with your withholdings and such. And then, of course, all the real estate taxes that you pay, that adds up to quite a lot. So now we're down to number two and number one.
Okay, is either one of these the federal estate tax? An inheritance?
Oh, that's a good one. No,
it's not.
That is not one of these.
I'm really surprised, because that's one of the big things you hear all the time.
The $5 million deduction.
Yeah, everybody's upset about the $5 million deduction. We could get so much more money when people die. Mm-hmm. You know, like You know, yeah, but it's not. That's but, surprising.
But so far, we've seen that the statistics are saying that, you know, people that are subject to that tax, there's not that many people. And so even though maybe it taxes the rich more, and you're talking about a large dollar amount to an individual estate, it's not there's not that many people that are subject to that. So that is not it. Okay.
Social Security?
Number two, well, no.
We already talked about that.
Yes, we did.
Medicare?
Capital gains rates on stock sales and dividends, the 20% or the 15% maximum.
Well, you want to kill the economy. You just take away capital gain treatment and on stocks and dividend treatment on stocks. You take that away and you call it ordinary income, and you watch how fast the economy comes. It's already at a screeching halt, but it'll shut the door.
That's a good point. $616 billion. So a huge amount of available money. See, if you're from the government and you're looking at potential ways
to tap into our money.
Exactly. Yeah. Capital gains rates.
They totally disregarded that. The fact that keeps the economy going, that keeps things moving, that gets people spurring to put money into the market. And if you don't have that incentive, people won't do it.
That's right. Number one, $760 billion. By far, 25% more than the number two tax break on the list.
Capital gains.
Non-taxable health insurance benefits through your work. Yes.
Oh, that's going to get resolved, though, with Obamacare, right?
It very may well. So $760 billion of that. So if you're looking from a federal government standpoint, where can you raise more funds? They have talked about making some of that health insurance benefit taxable. And in fact, in 2018, if you have a Cadillac plan, the employer will be paying some tax by providing a Cadillac plan.
So you do know what's going to happen to those Cadillac plans.
Goodbye.
They're going to be gone. Yeah.
Yep. So if we look at the top five, we've got the employer health insurance, the capital gains rates, the state and local taxes, and the mortgage interest deduction, and then the Medicare benefits. Clearly, Medicare, they're not going to touch that. That's going to stay as it is. There's no chance of that being taxed. The state and local taxes, yes, we're probably looking at them putting a cap on itemized deductions or putting either a percentage cap saying, hey, you can only take 30% of your income in a year as an itemized deduction, or maybe only $30,000. So clearly, if they cap that, they're going to be able to tap into some money there. And then capital gains rates, probably 20% instead of 15%, maybe back up to 28% like it used to be, taking ordinary dividends out of the favorable being called long-term investments and taxing them as ordinary income. That's a very real possibility. And then, of course, who knows what's going to happen with the health insurance premiums, because there's been a lot of, if they just change that one thing alone, boy, that's a chunk of change.
Well, you know, Kevin, we, as I'm sure you do, and I know Carl does too, we get updates from various organizations we work with on things that are going on in the pea brains of the government officials. And one of the things that is on the table that they are looking at is exactly doing that, is taking away the capital gains treatment. And that's been a real concern of mine for a long time, because I think that would be a tragic mistake for our economy and would kill any kind of recovery in the short term.
I agree with you. And, you know, one last comment before we go to break here, back on the stepped-up basis issue, one of the areas that the more liberal side of Oregon politics has been pushing is for Oregon to not allow stepped-up basis, because, and their argument is, hey, we're taking capital gains off of the table that could have been accumulated of all of all of these years, and we're not taxing capital gains, and we're letting the wealthy pass this on to their children. Well, here's what they're calling capital gains. In the 1950s, husband and wife buy a home for $30,000. By the time they pass away 60 years later, that home is worth $150,000. and it's dilapidated, and it needs a ton of repairs. It's nothing like the home that they bought for $30,000, yet we've got $120,000 of appreciation that they're calling capital gains that they would like to tax. And that type of reasoning just doesn't make sense. On the flip side of the argument, there's if you look at a stock that may have true you know, appreciation in value over a number of years, then, you know, that's not just associated with appreciation, but true gain. Those are all mixed into the same pot and called capital gains. So I think that's where the argument comes in is, hey, you can talk about a stock that maybe did really, really well and there is true gain, or you could talk about a piece of property that's gone down in value yet gone up in value, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, that's one of the things we've talked about on this show last year, and we'll be talking about it at the end of this year. But, you know, with the thought that the government could possibly do away with the capital gain treatment, we're telling our clients right now that you need to take a really good look at your stock this year. And if you, we tell clients to never fall in love with a stock, but let's be honest. There are people who buy Starbucks or Microsoft or Intel or whatever because somebody in their family worked there, or they like it, or they go to Starbucks, they buy the stock and they keep it, and they want to hold on to that stock for virtually forever. But I tell them, I said, look, I was just thinking about a client that I have right now that we were talking about this, and I started doing some tax planning with them right now, and I said, look, you've got a ton of capital gains build up in that stock. Maybe this should be the year you should think about selling that stock, turn around and rebuy it the next day, as long as you're not taking the tax loss. Everybody thinks there's a 30-day rule, but that only applies if you're taking the tax deduction as a loss.
That's right.
Well, if you've got gains built up, gosh, maybe in December this year you need to really look at your portfolio, take out all those capital gains, because if this thing happens, yep. Once it happens, it happens.
That's exactly right. Well, as we go to break here, I do have to say I thank Forbes for the excellent article and the breakdown on all these deductions. I didn't want to give that out beforehand because I know you guys would jump on the web and check out my list and steal my thunder. So, anyway.
Oh, good job, Kevin. I like it. That's really good. I think it also gives you some insight into the mentality of the government on their taxation theory, because their theory is that all the money we make is really theirs. And what they decide to take from us and give us the rest to live on is what they'll do.
That's right.
They're looking at it as almost like a cost of business. You know, in other words, this is what it costs us to get a profit. You know, we're losing this much money by doing these good things for you.
Well, you know, I wouldn't mind it if there was any accountability in the way they spend money, but there just isn't. That's the problem. I mean, if you know, a business, there's accountability because there's a day comes when you got to pay your taxes. And you got to pay your bills, and if you don't, they come haul you away.
Maybe so. There should be something equivalent to the IRS looking over the, you know, I mean, you know, the IRS.
Oh, God, we don't need another governmental agency. Hey, we're going to take a quick break and come back with the Knowledge Trust. If you got a question, give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We'll be right back with the Knowledge Trust.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust, at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Well, I'd buy.
Well, listen, if you have $1 million, give us a call and we'll tell you what you can do with it and how we can help you turn that into more money. Everybody likes more money, right? Okay. And, you know, Kevin, that was a great segment that you just had there about the government taxation. And what you were also doing some other figures, or what did you come up with?
Well, it's a total of all those. The top 15 is $5 trillion over 5 years, so it's about $1 trillion a year for those top 15.
So yeah, so even if they did that and enacted that, with the national debt being almost $17 trillion, it would take off how much a year? About $1 trillion?
That's right.
So 17 wow. years, they could get it taken care of.
Yeah, if they didn't increase any more spending, that's the problem. We're printing $85 billion a month, which is a little over $1 trillion a year. And we got a caller on the phone here. David's got a tax question. David, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah, I do. Tax question. I have a small business, and accounts that I have, it's a service industry, accounts that I have, a couple of them went bad, and so how do I write that off? I mean, I can zero it out, I think, as far as it doesn't show income on the bottom line, or it doesn't show, you know, gross sales. But how do I do that?
I know exactly what you're asking. That's a great question. Do you report your income on the cash basis? In other words, when you receive cash, that's when you report it? Or do you report it on the accrual basis when you charge the client? That's when you report your income.
Yeah, the last is what I do.
Okay, so in that case, you do get a write-off of the account, because when you send out your invoice to the client, and then you're going to be recording that into income. And so if it were, you know, say, you know, $20,000 that you've charged them, that's going to be in your gross sales. And certainly you don't want to pay tax on that if they've defaulted and you have no chance of collecting. And so you would... there's a what we call a journal entry, but basically you would record a bad debt allowance into your expense. You'd still keep the $20,000 in your net sales, but you would also have a $20,000 expense of bad debt write-off, and that would get the receivable off of your books and put the loss down into your profit and loss, and then you would not be paying tax on that then.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you very much.
That was a great question, David. You know, that's one of the things I think that a lot of people don't realize. When you're a small business owner, and like in David's case, whatever service he might have provided, he could have went out and provided the service, and then all of a sudden, the people didn't pay the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So he did the work, but now he's either got to go litigate them, or he's got to write it off.
That's right. You know, one confusion that a lot of people have, and it doesn't feel right, but it is right, is when you're on the other basis of reporting, the cash basis, like I mentioned at first, if you're thinking, hey, I just did all this work, I'm due $20,000, but the guy's not going to pay me. I have some loss there. But unfortunately, you can't write the time of your services off. If you didn't record it into income, you don't get a deduction for it either. And so that's a hard one for people to understand and swallow.
Are there rules associated with determining whether you can choose to be an accrual basis or a cash basis
lots of
taxpayer?
Rules. Lots of rules, yes. Mm. Yeah. For the most part, small businesses have a lot of flexibility. Once you're up into the million or $10 million range, then you're forced to do accrual in many occasions, circumstances. So.
Well, you know, and speaking about those kind of things like accrual and cash and things, comes to mind a topic that I was talking about this week, and that is the rule of 72. And, you know, we've talked about the rule of 72, but I think a lot of people get confused not only on taxes, but get confused about how their money actually grows. And the rule of 72 is a way of calculating compounding interest on your investment. And here's the simplest way to kind of bring this out to somebody, because it can be complex. Now, if you like numbers, which Kevin, obviously you do and I do, and we like numbers. Carl doesn't like. Carl likes reading about laws. And,
he likes concepts.
He likes those conceptual laws. But you know, if you take the rule of 72 and just divide, let's say you have 10 years and you have a little dollar, and you want that dollar to grow and double, and you want it to double in 10 years. So if you divide 10 into 72, it comes out to 7.2% a year. Now, this is the miracle of compounding interest. It's a very hard concept for a lot of people to take, but if you take the simplified interest rate over 10 years, is 7.2, if we're saying 7.2%, so if you make 7.2 per year times 10 is how much? It's 72. So it's not 100. So how did we go from 72 to from 72 to 100? That's the miracle of compounding interest, because you're not only making that 7.2 on your first dollar, you're making the 7.2 on the 7.2 that you made the year before. It's a compounding effect. And a lot of people have trouble understanding that concept. And the reason I bring this up, numbers can work to fool you, and numbers can work to help you, but in the reality of interest rates and numbers, you always want to look at the real rate of return. In this case, if you had a dollar and you earned 7.2% compounding interest, and that dollar doubled in 10 years, what was your simple rate of interest that you actually made? Well, if you know, no compounding, just simple interest, tells you that you would have made about a 10% return, because 10% a year is 10 cents of a dollar. In 10 years times 10, you now have $2, right? Very simple concept. Now, you want to throw a curve into it. You calculate average annual return and throw that in. And I got news for you. You talk about confusing. You can look at prospectuses and programs that show a 10% rate of return, in reality return 6%, and that's your money. So if you want to learn more about your money, call us next Saturday. We'll be back with Investing Simplified. Have a great weekend, guys. Hope you have a great weekend. I hope the weather is supposed to be great all week.
I think
so. Enjoy the week, and figure out some questions to call in and ask us next week. Thank you very much for listening to Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, wealth management. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
The time to stop working is approaching.